Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. The name refers to the fact that the state isn't red or blue, it's both. Most of you are probably trying to take a break from political news, but thanks for tuning in as we discuss lessons learned from this election cycle and what we may expect in the next 4 years. I'm KUNR editor Vicky Adame, and I'm filling in for Lucia Starbuck. For this episode, Lucia is on the other side, sharing her thoughts on the election. Joining her are senior correspondent Bert Johnson and KNPR political reporter Paul Boger. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Lucia, you've been on the ground covering this election since February. What are you hearing about why Nevada went red for president for the first time in 2 decades?
It's very clear that Nevada is very purple, but when you talk to voters throughout this year, the economy came up again and again and again, and in a number of different ways. You know, people are struggling to pay for gas, groceries, their electricity bill went up, they're either trying to become a homeowner and can't, or they're a homeowner and now they can't afford other things, or they go into debt trying to fix their home. And I think the Donald Trump campaign really capitalized on that. They said, if you've been struggling in the last 4 years, that's Biden and Harris's fault. So vote for us and we'll change that for you. And I think that message was really successful. Kamala Harris's campaign focused a lot on democracy and being anti-Trump, which I think did resonate with some voters who were very concerned after January 6th.
And Paul, you spent the week leading up to the election in Las Vegas. What role did Clark County specifically play in electing Trump this election?
I think that's a really interesting question, because when you look at voter turnout across the state, yes, it was higher in raw numbers than, say, 2020, but as a percentage of overall turnout, it was lower than 2020. So it wasn't a historic turnout. And when you look at Clark County specifically, of course, that's where a vast majority of the voters live. But when you look at the numbers, there just wasn't that blue defense. There wasn't that Democratic turnout like we've seen in 2016 or 2020. As a matter of fact, Biden won Clark County in 2020 by about 50 votes. Harris was only able to win it by about 25,000, 30,000 votes at this point. Much lower turnout there, and it just wasn't enough to hold out a lot of the turnout that we saw in rural Nevada, whereas Democrats and nonpartisans seemed to be a little bit more split, a little bit more conflicted.
There was a switch this time around with the early voting. Mm-hmm. Republicans really turned out for early voting. What do you think attributed to that?
Trump's campaign telling people to vote early, something that he hasn't done in the past. In 2020, he cast doubt on mail-in ballots, saying that they're thrown into the river, things like that. I remember covering J.D. Vance's rally over the summer, already telling people to vote early. The Republicans really, they said, if Democrats are doing it, so should we. And that's exactly what they did this election, something we haven't seen before.
I think they were also trying to get past the red mirage that happened in 2020. And that was actually a big part of the fuel that fed the fire of election denialism, was the fact that you had Democrats trusting and utilizing mail ballots. You had Democrats turning out early. And then Republican voters, at that point at least, were really dedicated to the traditional experience of voting in person on Election Day. And so they started tabulating those Election Day results, and that looked like Republicans were doing really well. And then as those mail ballots started to get processed and added to the count, that's where you started to see things tip towards Biden and other Democrats in that election. And I think that's part of what they were thinking, was trying to get past that hurdle.
Bert, you've been following the far-right influences. What impacts did this have on the race?
I think that's a really interesting question, because a big part of the on-the-ground get-out-the-vote strategy for this Trump re-election campaign actually got farmed out to Turning Point USA. That's Charlie Kirk's national nonprofit organization. He originally started this off as a way to reach conservative college students. After the pandemic, he pivoted to working with churches, and specifically with evangelical churches. He began another branch of his outfit of the broader Turning Point ecosystem, which is called Turning Point USA Faith, that was co-founded by a pastor from a Calvary chapel in Southern California. What that looked like during this election was they were specifically using churches and congregations to try and drive the vote for Trump. evangelicals are a strong presence in American life, but they're not a majority. And so it appears to have worked pretty well for them. But to get back to the point of extremism, a big part of what activates and motivates those voters and their pastors and their congregations is this idea of the Seven Mountains Mandate. I talked to religion scholar Matthew D. Taylor about this a while back. Here's how he describes it.
You divide society up into seven arenas of influence: government, family, education, business and commerce, arts and entertainment, media. Imagine each of those as mountains. And the tops of those mountains are either controlled by Satan and the demons or by God and the Christians. There are no other parties. There's no one else, right? It's completely Manichaean. It's one or the other, good or evil.
Basically, the idea behind the Seven Mountains is they're coming from a position where they argue that the United States was originally founded as a Christian country that was supposed to be directed and governed according to biblical principles. That's not true, but there's a whole industry within the evangelical political right dedicated to finding ways to argue that this is the case. One of the Seven Mountains is government. And so getting Trump to be in charge of the whole government is a big achievement for them.
So as we know, this won't be Trump's first time in the White House. But this time around, he's surrounding himself with people who've proven to be loyal to him. What can we expect from a second Trump presidency?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Vicky, he's already choosing major positions about the people he wants around him. Secretary of State, Department of Health. He's even created a Department of Government Efficiency with Elon Musk. I think he's learned from the first term. Now he knows a little bit about what to expect. And he's casting doubt and distrust in major federal government institutions. I talked to Associate Political Science Professor Tim Lindberg from the University of Minnesota Morris, and he said that's, for him, that's the biggest thing that he's worried about, is these ramifications of distrust in government.
I don't think anybody forgets what the first Trump administration ended with, right? January 6th, people invading the Capitol, Trump at the very least kind of standing by and not exhorting them to stop until it was already too late, potentially more than that, right, in terms of encouraging them and egging them on, and being impeached a second time for that. And that certainly was not the only instance of pushing against institutions, breaking norms, pushing at the edges of constitutional boundaries on these things.
And he's acting a lot quicker than he did in his first term.
To build off of Lucia's point, the first time Trump won the presidency, I've seen a lot of analysis that suggests he sort of didn't expect to win. And so in some ways, his administration was putting together their agenda as they went. At this point, they've had years to work on it. And if you look at things like his Agenda 47 or Project 2025, you can see they've really put some time and resources into developing a clear agenda for this eventuality, him getting back into the White House. And so I think it is going to be more efficient. I would not be surprised if you saw a stronger influence of some of these far-right figures, some of the donors who have supported him all along, because he has more to reward them for at this point.
Bert, you brought up Project 2025. It makes you wonder how much of that is going to be put through and how quickly. What government agencies will just be like dismantled and destroyed completely, or if he's going to just look for total control of these government organizations through people who support what he wants to get done. Here in Nevada, it makes me think about like environmental agencies. What's going to happen with mining in Nevada? Are major mining projects just going to be kind of rammed through without a lot of regulations, or just trying to get done super quickly before the next presidential election? The possibility of a national abortion ban, even though Trump has said he's not going to take that up, but now he has Republican control of all three branches of government.
I think a couple of things, especially when we're talking about the environment. We've already seen BLM act in the last several months in a way that seems like they were trying to greenlight as many projects as they can before the Trump administration comes into office. That said, I do wonder what they're going to do with public lands. We have seen throughout the course of this campaign talk from Trump about opening public lands around Las Vegas and Reno for more development, especially affordable housing development. But also, you know, we have the lithium loop. We've also got oil and gas extraction possibilities on public land in Nevada. And now you've also got the Colorado River Compact, which is coming to an end in 2026, where you're going to have seven states and Mexico trying to decide how they're going to use the Colorado River. And of course, we have this now concern about what is the administration going to do about federal emergency funds with the Eastern Sierra, a tinderbox. So we're going to have at some point a major wildfire come through the Sierra. What happens if Trump has decided that he's going to withhold federal funding or federal emergency management funding from California in case California does something to anger him? When you come to education, I think that's actually one of the reasons we saw so much of a difference in Clark County. I didn't mention it earlier. Clark County is the fifth largest school district in the entire country, and it has some of the worst educational outcomes of any school district in the entire country. And you're seeing more and more anger. And I think that's driving a lot of parents, and especially young Latino families, towards the education choice movement, trying to get their kids into private schools, charter schools. And they're seeing Republicans talk about that much more than they're seeing Democrats talk about that. Now you're going to have this debate over whether the Department of Education should exist or not. Nevada is a state that takes in a lot of federal money through the Department of Education. So I think it's going to be an incredibly interesting debate in the legislature here in the next couple of months on what we're going to do with a Clark County school district, how much money we get from the federal government, and can Nevada operate schools if that money were to suddenly disappear or change in how it can be accessed.
Now, another area Trump ran on is immigration. He promised on day one mass deportations. While there are those who say that's impossible, it can't happen, history has shown us otherwise through the operation in 1954 and again in the 1930s. In this day and age, how feasible is a mass deportation and what would it look like?
I think it's an open question as to how feasible it is, but here's another lesson we can take from history. Anytime you're trying to control a huge population of people, there's going to be violence, unfortunately, because some of the suggestions they've floated, right, are activating National Guard, deploying federal law enforcement agents and border agents in communities throughout the country.
Workplace raids.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. These are all very heavy-handed tactics, and it's only a matter of time before something goes wrong. We've also already seen, under the first Trump administration, the way that they were detaining people who were coming to the U.S. border with Mexico asking for asylum, that resulted in deaths from negligence, from people not getting the medications they needed, from malnutrition. You saw children being separated from their parents, and that has a long-term impact.
I think it's really interesting because I would talk to Republican voters who were going to support Trump before the election, and I would kind of ask, do you support rounding people up? Do you support these mass deportations? And people were like, no, no, that's just politics. He's not actually going to do that. But I think it is very possible. And Vicky, when you ask like what that could look like, I think it can look like a number of things. Which countries allow people back into the country? Who was allowed in this country legally under Biden, who don't have protections like asylum, who are already on a list, their addresses are available? That's who's going to get rounded up first, the people who are easily accessible. Another thing I think it's going to do is just also what happened under Trump's first presidency. When you have such a hostile attitude and rhetoric, people are going to be wondering, is it even worth coming to the United States if I'm going to be treated this way? Maybe I don't even attempt it at all.
Well, and that's the goal, right? They're trying to dissuade people from coming to the United States, at least if you come from a poor country. During Trump's first term, of course, he asked, why aren't more people coming here from Sweden and other places like that? But that is the point. It is supposed to dissuade people from applying for asylum, for coming here to find work, whether they're documented or not. I mean, a lot of this goes back to, again, strategies that the right has been working on for quite some time. They've invested a lot of resources into building a narrative that immigration, especially from poor countries, is dangerous to the United States.
That's something that you heard throughout the campaign trail. You know, immigrants are overcrowding schools, hospitals, roadways, resources. They're getting all these handouts.
Yeah, I mean, if you listened to the Trump campaign, deportations were essentially the cure-all, the panacea for all of the country's ills. Oh, there's an affordable housing crisis? Well, deport more people, there'll be more housing. Oh, you need more jobs? Deport more people, there'll be more jobs. But what you're going to see is Nevada has somewhere between 170 and 190,000 people who are undocumented. A lot of them have lived here for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. They're integrated into the community. They are part of the workforce. And in a state where you don't have income taxes, guess what? They're probably paying the same number of taxes that you are at your grocery store or when they go out to buy something. And I think that there's going to be a shock. When you talk to voters who supported Donald Trump, when they talked about mass deportation, they were talking about wanting to get the quote unquote criminals, the cartels, the drug dealers. They want those people gone. Now, if you can quickly find quote unquote those people, how do you do that?
I think, you know, Paul, you brought up a point about like the tax base. Undocumented people do pay taxes. They don't get it back. Under an ITIN, the Individual Taxpayer Identification Number, they're paying into Social Security and Medicare. They're the ones that are keeping those programs afloat to the tune of billions of dollars. What happens when that base is gone?
Right.
And also you brought up that, that the jobs will be available once you deport all these people. But the reality is, what are the jobs that these immigrants are doing? And how fast are people going to rush to be out working in 100 plus degree heat, bent over picking tomatoes, working in the meat packing, mm-hmm. working in the dairies? Those are the jobs. They're available, but why aren't quote unquote Americans willing to do those?
It's also like a big question of how quickly this will happen. Where you're seeing Republicans who over the last 4 years have been like, well, Biden didn't do anything, Harris didn't do anything. But now they're kind of taking a more of a patient approach. I interviewed Congressman Mark Amadei, and he was like, well, you know, it's going to take a while. You can't just do that immediately. And that's not wrong. I mean, who's going to carry all this out? Where are you going to place people? Do you have enough judges, ICE, Border Patrol? Do you have enough manpower to carry out these mass deportations? I think that's going to vary by state and community too.
Nevada went red for president, but blue for Senate. These races show how the state maintains its purple identity. You're listening to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm KUNR editor Vicky Adame, and I'm your host today. I'm joined by political reporter Lucia Starbuck, senior correspondent Bert Johnson, and KNPR political reporter Paul Boger. All three branches of government will be controlled by Republicans at the federal level. But let's bring it back down to the state. A red wave didn't take place here. Nevada re-elected Democratic incumbent Jackie Rosen. Paul, what led to her success?
I think that when you look at the Jackie Rosen campaign or the Senate campaign in general, Rosen really, really ran on her bipartisan bona fides, right? If you went on her About Me section of her website, the word bipartisan showed up at least a dozen times. If you saw one of her commercials, she talked about how she was the most bipartisan senator. So I really think that that was able to at least put concerns at ease for a lot of maybe nonpartisan voters who were worried about electing a quote-unquote super liberal Democrat. I also think that you saw Jackie Rosen really talk about some more local issues versus some of the national stuff that Sam Brown's campaign was focused on. First off, I'm not convinced Sam Brown ran a good campaign. At no point in the early part of that campaign did we, as reporters or journalists, hear from him. And I'm not saying that you have to talk to the media to run a good campaign, but you know, if you're not a well-known candidate in a state that you're not originally from, it helps. That also being said, he focused a lot on immigration, on the economy. Jackie Rosen, on the other hand, talked a lot about bringing jobs to rural communities through solar development, through lithium mining. There's a big, huge renewable energy economy that's happening in Nevada, and Jackie Rosen was talking about that in those rural communities, and that matters to them. And I think that abortion continues to be a winning issue for congressional Democrats. Now, was it a big winning issue for Kamala Harris? Doesn't seem to be. But at least when it comes to Congress, where any potential abortion legislation will go, that does seem to be a winning issue. You also saw it on the ballot question here with question six. So I think all of that combined, she was really able to scratch out a win almost exclusively because she ran on her bipartisan bona fides.
I think that really did help her. You saw lifelong Republican mayors endorse her, the Sparks mayor, Ely mayor. Their reasons were, yeah, look at her track record, look at the money that she's securing in our local communities. She picks up the phone when we call. Sometimes she calls us first. So I think she's built a lot of relationship and trust, including in rural communities, that she is going to get things done.
It's an interesting question, though, because some of the post-election analysis that I've seen, at least about the presidential race, indicates that part of the problem with Democrat turnout is people were not excited to participate because they didn't see a campaign that was doing enough. In some ways, it almost feels like Rosen's focus on being a bipartisan lawmaker, her position as a relatively conservative Democrat, that working out for her seems to be the opposite of what may have happened with the presidential race.
You know, you saw that with Harris kind of parading out, here's the Republican who supports me now. I think it kind of backfires for people who are looking for very progressive and social changes. I think a big thorn in the Democratic Party this election was pro-Palestine Democrats feeling extremely excluded, feeling like that there was absolutely no change from Biden to Harris.
Strategically, though, the Republicans also have a huge advantage because they always embrace their activist fringe.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the biggest features of the MAGA movement. Since 2016, the GOP has welcomed all kinds of activists, extremists, conspiracy theorists with open arms. It seems to be working out quite well for them. On the other hand, you have the sort of staid, traditional conservative wing of the Democrat Party doing everything it can to distance itself from its activist base, on a national level at least.
There's one Republican who's maintained his seat since 2011, and that's Congressman Mark Amadei. Lucia, you covered the race. So what were your main takeaways?
That was interesting from the start to see after candidate filing happened and the Democrats did not put anyone up against Amadei. He ran against nonpartisan challenger Greg Kidd. And I think a big question was that going to be very competitive? Is he going to blow Amadei out of the water? Is he going to capture all these nonpartisans? And he really didn't. The election results look pretty similar and sometimes worse than Democrats that Amadei has ran against in the past. I think something that came up during that race, and same thing with the Senate race, like, how Nevadan are you? Kidd was critiqued for having California license plates.
Bolo tie.
He put on his bolo tie incorrectly, which for Nevadans is a really big deal of how long have you been here, or do you really understand this kind of weird and unique state? So I think that came up a lot. But on the other side, another thing, I think people are kind of getting sick of Amadei, but are wondering if there's ever going to be a truly competitive race there. I know Kidd put on his Kidd 2026 hat. But people still really like Amadei, and it's, again, kind of the incumbent effect. You know, maybe the longer he's been in there, the more he can get done.
It's so interesting to think about the race in that district this time around where Democrats didn't even field a candidate. I can't help but feel like that was a strategic misstep, especially on the state legislative level in Nevada. There are a lot of districts where you don't see a Democrat running. And I think for the Democrats or perhaps the swing voters or the nonpartisans who live in those districts, they might want to have a choice, and they're not getting one. I'm not a political strategist, but I do think that there's something to be said for a party showing up, being present, and being engaged.
Because I did hear from voters like, I don't really know Kidd, but it's not Amadei, so I'll give him my vote.
I still don't know who Greg Kidd is, and I still don't know why he ran for office in Northern Nevada. I don't mean that to be mean, but he spent a lot of money to do pretty poorly in an election that he probably should have at least gotten 40 to 45% just running as an opposition to the incumbent. Mark Amadei, will say this, is incredibly likable. When you meet Mark Amadei, he is an affable guy. He will charm your pants off. I have seen him walk into a room that was ready for blood and completely walk out, you know, glad handing, kissing babies, and everything was great.
Hometown hero, the
hometown
crowd.
Hometown hero, you know, how about them Carson Senators, right? He is that kind of constituent services sort of congressman. And I think that bodes well to his popularity. I'd argue he's still probably the most popular Republican in this state. Arguably he's more popular than the governor, but it's a much different job as well. It's his seat for as long as he wants it. Democrats, unfortunately, in Northern Nevada, still aren't going to be competitive, I think, at least for another cycle, another 10 years maybe, until the next census, until there's a redistricting, mainly because there's just not the numbers, right? You've got the Reno-Sparks area versus 5, 6, 7 of the state's rural counties, so a majority of the rurals, the numbers just aren't going to be there for Democrats for a while. So if you do want to see a competitive race, it's probably going to be with an independent, nonpartisan candidate, but it needs to be a nonpartisan candidate who stands for something other than, hey, I'm a guy who moved here and I live in In-Kind Village, and boy, wouldn't it be nice to have a new congressman.
We're gearing up for the legislative session, which starts in February. What's the makeup looking like?
Well, as of right now, it looks like Republicans are going to pick up one seat in each chamber. And that is, while not huge wins for Republicans, it is absolutely enough to make sure that Democrats don't have a supermajority in either chamber in Carson City. So that's a big deal for Republicans. It forces the Democratic majority to negotiate on some of those bigger bills that we're going to be talking about. And there's plenty to be talking about coming up in February. I know one of the things I'm looking at is this massive tax deal that we're going to be building movie studios in Southern Nevada. How much money is the state going to be negotiating with? Who's going to be involved? What's that looking like? I think that's one of those bills that you're going to see used as one of those bargaining chips that's going to force a lot of other negotiations in Carson City. So I think that what you've seen overall is that Democrats did okay throughout the election. They spent a huge amount of money to just do okay against Republicans who, by and large, at least down ballot, didn't spend as much money, didn't campaign quite as hard, but are still reaping some of the benefits from the top of the ticket.
I don't think Democrats are done fighting for access to reproductive care. We saw Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro, you know, months ago already saying she's planning on putting forward a bill to protect access to IVF and even try to make it more affordable or more insurance coverage. As Paul mentioned, since they don't have those supermajorities, what are they going to do about all those bills that Governor Joe Lombardo vetoed last time? We've seen Assemblywoman Sandra Haudegui already promise to bring back some of her gun restriction legislation. Since I covered the diaper tax ballot question, you know, I've heard advocates talking about some form of child care. So I think there's lots of things. I mean, education, housing. Are there going to be any election-related bills? Maybe open primaries. I think there's going to be a lot to talk about.
You've been hearing from KNR political reporter Lucia Starbuck, senior correspondent Bert Johnson, and KNPR political reporter Paul Boger. I'm Vicky Adame, and you've been listening to Purple Politics Nevada.